Hello, friends. Welcome back to another episode of the WFO Life podcast. In this episode, we're jumping into the health corner again. We're going to talk about health as it relates to the heart. We're going to talk about nutrition. We're going to talk about lifestyle. And we're going to dig into all kinds of research related to how nutrition, medications, and lifestyle tie in to various diseases of the heart. This will be very important for somebody that's trying to get the most out of their health, especially if you're trying to prevent congestive heart failure, coronary artery disease, or any of these other kind of heart ailments. We'll cover all kinds of stuff in this. And once again, my guest is going to be Dr. John Sullivan today, and we're going to delve into it. And it starts out fiery and continues at a pretty fast pace throughout. I hope you enjoy this series. I've enjoyed talking about kind of lifestyle and things that are important for health that don't come in a bottle necessarily. And now it's time for the bumper music. Welcome to the WFO Life Podcast. Buckle up for interviews, insights, and practical discussions, and the occasional intellectual oddity, all designed to help you master self, master craft, and accomplish any life mission. Okay, folks, this is Dr. William Curtis again with the WFO Life Podcast. I'm here once again with my colleague, Dr. John Sullivan, and we are going to be covering a topic on Heart Awareness Month. Lots of things we could cover here, but want to welcome you back to the WFO Life Podcast.
Well, thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, gauging by the interest in our last several talks on various health-related topics, I thought in honor of February being Heart Awareness Month that maybe we could talk about some issues related to how nutrition might relate to the health of the human heart, various aspects of that. Perhaps even maybe some alternative ways we can improve the heart of even a diseased heart.
Yeah, it's a big topic because heart disease is the number one killer in the U.S. today and worldwide. So it's a big topic and one to really discuss. Yep. And there's so much misinformation about the heart and the way we treat it.
Yep.
And to me, and you might not like me saying this, but especially the cardiology profession, they're probably some of the most arrogant people in the world. And they have the worst track record in all of medicine, if you think about it, because they treat the number one killer. And heart disease rates are on the increase.
Boom. John Sullivan has arrived on the WFO Life Podcast.
Yeah. I got to tell you this.
You just pulled both barrels out, I think.
I did. And I get aggravated with that profession because what is it? Every time you go to a cardiologist, you know, just to get a simple procedure, it's $50,000 a pop.
Yeah, it is.
And you look at an orthopedist. Orthopedic procedure is $1,500, and these guys have the worst track record. They have the if you were a mechanic and most of your cars you worked on failed, you wouldn't be in business long.
Right.
But if you're a cardiologist, it's okay. And they and what do they always say? The definition of insanity: continue to do the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. And when the same thing keeps happening.
Now, keep in mind, sometimes these folks are coming in. Barely limping across, you know, that with massive vascular problems and things like that. So sometimes you got to look at the cohort of people they're dealing with.
I do understand that, but I think their whole premise of what causes heart disease is off.
Now, I think we could probably agree with that.
And here I am, you know, cardiovascular business is, you know, now, here's a person that's sitting across from me. When I first started working with him years ago, over a decade ago, I came in with a bunch of studies, research, because I was into looking at all the studies and reading all this stuff. And I'd throw it on his desk. And what amazed me, I've never had a medical doctor do this. He had a stack he threw back at me. This is a guy who actually reads the research, stays current on the research, and devours it. He's always looking to improve his knowledge base. I don't know many medical doctors who do that.
That's called competitive learning.
Competitive learning.
Yeah. But trying to keep up with you.
That's always amazed me about you, Doc, that you've always been really good about looking at the current literature. Now, I know you'll love this one right here. I have it. It was published in the British Medical Journal. And it was a Johns Hopkins study. It says medical error is the third leading cause of death in the U.S. I hate to throw that one at you. Sorry.
Nope. Yep.
But again, to my point, you know, error, the medical profession is the third leading cause of death in the U.S., which accounts for 250,000 patients a year die.
Is that the same data that's overlapping with medication errors? Is that the same?
Lot of it, what they were talking about, 200,000 people die from medications, but in those cases, you know, 50,000 were medical errors, okay. But in 200,000 of them, the right diagnosis was made, the right medication was prescribed, but the patient had an unintended consequence
right.
that occurred from that medication, because all medications have side effects.
Correct.
Which we free, and that accounted for 200,000 of those deaths. They weren't even errors.
Gosh. Yeah, that's huge.
So, and a lot of times what we're treating the symptoms of malnutrition, which is what I'll say a lot, with poison, drugs.
Right.
Because working at a construction company, I work at Bay Limited as a right. wellness director. And we're a construction company. We do industrial contracting. We build modules and highways and bridges and all kinds of stuff.
Right.
If I give the guys out in the field the right blueprint and they're in the right building material, there's nothing those guys can't make, nothing they can't put together, nothing they can't build. And our body's the same way. You know, we have the right blueprint. It's in the DNA of every cell of your body. So what if I go out to the field and I give those guys the right blueprint, but I give them shoddy material to build with?
Yeah.
They're going to make compromises. They're going to build junk. We're out of business. What if I give your body inappropriate material to build with?
Mm-hmm.
It's got to make compromises, and that's when we get ill.
Right.
Well, making muscle tissue and things, the heart's a muscle. You nourish it, it heals.
Right.
And so that's the premise of what I want to talk about today, and maybe a lot of what we're looking at heart disease and the whole concept of the lipid hypothesis is totally off base and has been.
I like where you're going with this because, you know, we kind of started out at the beginning, you know, the field of cardiology, they get a lot of really sick people. And I think you're making a valid argument that perhaps the prevention aspects of how we develop heart disease of various types, not just blocked arteries, but maybe congestive heart failure. And also, I have a theory that some of these electrical anomalies we see a lot of, you know, why does a 50-year-old person with atrial fibrillation and these kind of things? I think there is a very real nutritional component to why people develop those, as I'm sure we're going to get into. So
the heart's the most electrical organ of the body. People think it's the brain. It is the heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's start with congestive heart failure. Congestive heart failure, there's multiple reasons, there's multiple causes that we could identify, but generically speaking, there's a lot of people, it's a common cause of death, congestive heart failure is.
It's an ugly cause of death.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it's the number one cause of pneumonia, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the primary causes of kidney failure, because when your heart fails, your kidneys fail.
Right.
Because they can't pump, it's not pumping blood through the kidneys, so the kidneys shut down.
It's dependent on the heart.
Yes,
yep.
And when the heart's not pumping very well, it's weak, it becomes flaccid, it's a weak muscle. You can't ventilate the lungs very well. You start having fluid building up in the lungs, and typically how people die from congestive heart failure, they drown in their own fluids.
Yep.
You start having fluid build up in your body, in your abdomen, and that's never a good sign. So congestive heart failure is really an ugly disease to build with. And believe it or not, what the studies show, one of the primary causes of congestive heart failure are statin or cholesterol-lowering drugs.
I've read that as well.
Why is that? Because the pathway that makes cholesterol is a pathway that also makes CoQ10.
Mm-hmm.
And Q is needed in muscle. It's needed in the mitochondria of the muscle to make energy.
Right.
That's why a lot of people that are on statin or cholesterol-lowering drugs always talk about feeling tired
right.
and run down.
Sometimes muscle cramping, achiness,
yeah.
things like that as well.
Well, the heart's a muscle too.
Right.
And so you're shutting down muscle function there in the heart. The heart requires 10 times the CoQ10 as any other muscle because it has 10 times the mitochondria of any muscle tissue in the body.
It doesn't get to rest very often, so it's got to have plenty of stores. Yeah.
Absolutely. It's got to have that energy demand in the heart, and you're shutting that energy process down.
Right.
That's not a very smart thing to do. Plus, how many people do you know are on high blood pressure, hypertensive medications?
Right.
What are those medications? Those are actually very powerful heart medications,
right.
like calcium channel blockers or ACE inhibitors and all these things. And those probably, in most of the time, hypertension is misdiagnosed. Mm-hmm. I mean, according to the Cochrane collaboration.
What do you mean by misdiagnosed?
Well, according to the Cochrane collaboration, if you're treating, and they're an independent research group. They take funding from no one, by the way. So they're in looking, they said after reviewing all the literature, if your blood pressure is 159 over 99 or lower, treating it with medications are of no value. Okay. Think about that. That's 160 over 100.
Okay.
And what are the medical recommendations?
Definitely
way below. Yeah, like 120
over
80.
Yeah.
80s
now, yeah.
Yeah, and that's crazy. And plus, what a lot of the medical journals are starting to say is there's so much error in taking blood pressure. I mean, this is 100-year-old technology.
Yeah, right. I mean, I could agree with that. There's blood pressure varies all day long.
Yes.
There's multiple reasons it changes. And actually, the research I've seen that the what we call ambulatory blood pressure, which is the blood pressure you take at home,
yes,
is more accurate than the artificial one you take in the medical office, where you might be stressed about, I'm going to get bad news. The guy in the white coat is going to maybe give me a shot. All those things that drive your sympathetic tone.
You just
got
through filling out insurance information.
Yeah, yeah. You dropped your $50 copay and all of that. So that is those are things that externally stimulate the fight or flight system in the body, and therefore you get high blood pressure. They actually show that the ambulatory, the ones you take at home, are actually more accurate.
Correct. Well, the British standard is you take blood pressure 3 times a day. Mm-hmm. You add it together, divide by 3, and you do that for 3 months.
Yeah, that's definitely more...
Yeah, because over time is what you're really looking for. Blood pressure is going to vary minute to minute, hour to hour, depending on your stress levels, depending on your activity levels, depending on your posture. If you have your legs crossed, your blood pressure is going to go way up.
Right.
If the nurse is asking you questions while she's taking your blood pressure, and how many people come in talking to and they want to tell you all their symptoms, and they're supposed to be calm and quiet when they're getting their blood pressure taken. Right. It makes a big difference.
Yeah.
Is their machine calibrated? Is a nurse having an off day that day? There's so many variable factors when it comes to taking blood pressure. And one reading, and you're put on a powerful heart drug for life.
Right.
And there's something just inherently wrong with that, I believe.
Let me interject, because it's one of my premises I'll keep bringing up through all the heart stuff is as far as the prevention aspect. If you look at a lot of times, we're taught if you have more than 2 consecutive elevated blood pressures, in a certain range, go ahead and you're supposed to treat them. But so often, we're treating people that have not done 1 iota of nutrition or lifestyle or fitness. Not 1 bit. They're being treated assuming they're not going to do anything. I think we should give people more the benefit of the doubt and actually write prescriptions for exercise and lifestyle and nutritional change. Because, I mean, half the time these people, they exercise a little bit and then they start feeling bad because we gave them a medication that's lowering their blood pressure lower than it needs to be.
And a lot of the studies show... A lot of the studies show that a lot of these blood pressure medications don't work. Mm-hmm. They don't improve outcomes. You think they do. And doctors, why do we take these things like ACE inhibitors, which show really no benefit? You really can't point to a published study showing benefit. You would think, oh, yeah, you do. Not really. And you're looking at calcium channel blockers, which kill tens of thousands a year, because these are very powerful heart drugs.
Yeah, they definitely drop blood pressure. Yep.
But they obliterate calcium channels, which are very important. The calcium channels are in a cell for a reason. They're functional. And calcium channel blockers obliterate those calcium channels. You know what the body's natural calcium channel blocker is? Magnesium.
Yeah.
So you're treating a magnesium deficiency with a medication that obliterates your calcium channels. That doesn't make sense. You're shutting down muscle function, and the heart's a muscle.
So what you just touched on is probably the juxtaposition of what I think we'll end up talking about is there's 2 different things that can happen. People walk in, medical doctor sees them, blood pressure's high. Ideally, they've checked their blood pressure multiple times in different environments, and their blood pressure is consistently high. If it is, then it could be treated. I understand there is one mode of treating it with a medication and artificially lowering it. But what I like what you're pointing out is what's something I try to teach with my patients. There are other ways to do that as well. Now, you have to hold it to the same standard. It has to be, if you think that adding magnesium or doing lifestyle changes is going to change your blood pressure, then you sure need to measure it. You need to make sure it does.
But you're having to, as a doctor, you're having to go upstream. They have hypertension. Okay, what caused it?
Right. Oh, yeah.
What caused it? Oh, that's your cholesterol's elevated. Okay, great. You give them medication to lower it. Okay, what caused it?
That often is
medicine.
Right.
That's healing. Right. And that's what we're not doing. We're not going upstream.
Right.
We're treating symptoms.
Right.
And that's why you'll never get outcomes. Because people will say all the time, well, my blood pressure's under control. Well, no, it's not. You're on medication.
Right.
If it was under control, you wouldn't need the medication. You're treating a symptom. and you're not taking that next step, okay, there's a lot of different things that can affect blood pressure. Have we explored that? That takes diligence.
Yeah,
that takes work.
Sleep apnea. I just did a whole topic on sleep disorders and the value of sleep. I mean, if you don't
sleep
7 to 9 hours a night, you can have hypertension.
That stresses the body.
Your blood sugars go higher.
Cortisol goes out of control. Yep. And I wanted to read a few studies here real quick that's going to kind of touch on this. And it says, and this is, again, medical news, cardiovascular death on the rise in the U.S. Now, and if you think about it, we have... One out of every three people are on a statin or cholesterol-lowering medication. Right. And heart disease is on the increase.
Yeah.
If it was cholesterol, if that was, you know, what we've all said it was, it causes sclerosing of the arteries and causes a heart attack, then those numbers should be going down, and they're not. They're actually going up.
Right.
So what we're doing isn't working. So, well, what does the medic... But there's a lot of literature, and you notice a practice of medicine is usually 10 to 15 years behind what's in the science. So what does this science actually have to say? And this is in the World Journal of Gastroenterology. Fat reduces inflammation. And
what year is this from?
This is published in 2011.
Okay.
So just to keep this in mind, fat reduces inflammation. We'll hang on to that for a little bit because you were talking about dietary.
Right.
And we're all told that fat is an evil, terrible thing.
Right.
But we know a lot of cardiovascular diseases are inflammatory in nature, and fat reduces inflammation. So is fat really the enemy here?
Right.
This is out of the British Medical Journal. And says lack of association or inverse association between low-density lipoprotein cholesterol and mortality in the elderly. So heart attacks occur mostly in the older generation. And what they're showing is LDL is actually when elderly have higher LDL levels, so bad cholesterol, so to speak, they actually have lower mortality rates. It's not what we've been told.
Right.
The statistics show people with elevated cholesterol live longer.
You know, John, at very least, there's a lot, you know, of course, you'll read a drug company study or one of these major studies that says if you lower your cholesterol, you're going to have less heart attacks. They have studies that say that. But here's the thing that always gets me. That research you just quoted is good research. It's in a quality journal. It was peer reviewed, all that type of thing. But the reality is every time you keep seeing data like that, I wish more people would stand up and say, how can we have data that shows exactly opposite? How can that's the thing that gets me is that everybody kind of buys into this idea that cholesterol must be the issue when you have data that shows LDL is completely, you know.
Well, here's the thing. Here's those studies because you always look at that because I've looked at studies with you and I said, well, this is a relative risk study. You picked it up, threw it in the trash and walked out the door. A lot of these things are not double blind studies. They're poorly weighted. They're relative risk studies.
Right.
They're not absolute risk studies. And Repatha is a big example of that. And the New York Times put out a big article and all the studies. Oh, Repatha is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It's a cholesterol lowering drug, by the way. It's $14,000 a year to take this stuff. And so it's the big ballyhoo of the time. But if you read Amgen's own study on Repatha, when you actually go in and take away the relative risk study and you look at the absolute risk, which is how many people do you have to treat to get a positive benefit in one? Well, in the Repatha study, you had to treat something like 167 patients over a 2.5 year period.
Really? Was that high?
Yes.
Wow.
To get at a cost of $2 million to stop one cardiac incident. And it did not reduce death rates.
Right.
No death reduction. And you had to treat, you know, 167 patients over a 2.5 year period to get a positive benefit in one.
Right.
At a cost of $2 million. So those are the studies that you cite that they say, lowering cholesterol has a benefit.
Right.
Oh, yeah. But the death rates. Now, here's the thing about Repatha. Here was the side effects of the drugs. It caused amyloid plaques in the brain.
Yeah. Also known as Alzheimer's disease.
Which is a hallmark of Alzheimer's. Yeah. So I might have lowered my chances of getting a heart attack, but now I don't know who I am.
Right.
So you trade one for the other. In all statin studies, you could look at a lot of studies that, we've showed relative risk that it reduces heart attack rates, but all-cause mortality in every statin study are higher.
Right.
It increases death rates of all-cause mortality, usually
accidents,
from cancer.
Suicides, cancer.
Cancer's the biggie.
Like
Yeah, because cholesterol is used by the body for immune function.
Yeah, hormone production.
Yeah, I mean, your
repair.
Body makes it. It's essential.
Right.
Cholesterol is essential for life. There can be no cellular life on Earth without cholesterol.
Right.
So here's this British Medical Journal puts out a study. Those with elevated cholesterol live longer. Imagine that. Mm-hmm. And this is in a journal, American College of Cardiology. 7-year outcomes of using angioplasty showed no benefit.
Okay, angioplasty being putting a balloon in an artery to open it to improve blood flow.
And we'll discuss why that is, because there's some studies that actually show why some of these interventional therapies, 5-year, 7-year, 10-year survival rates are actually you're worse off if you've had these interventional things done to you. And this was in Archives of Internal Medicine. Internal coronary stent implantation with medical therapy versus medical therapy alone. What they're showing is when you had a stent done, your outcomes were actually worse with stent. With surgical intervention, the outcomes were worse.
And what's interesting in a study like that is when they say versus medical management, well, that's blood pressure control. That's antiplatelet therapy. Maybe
nutrition.
But did they actually do nutrition in a study like that? That's the thing. A lot of these studies are sheerly the medicines they gave.
Right.
They don't actually show. It could be even better if you actually had a nutrition or lifestyle change.
Well, what was published in the American Diabetic Association, their journal, back in the 1970s, and it's a study that made the most popular diabetic drug in history.
Fenfen or something?
No, for diabetes, you're...
Oh, metformin or...
Yes, metformin. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It made metformin the blockbuster drug that it is today because it showed metformin was greatly beneficial and had fewer side effects than any other diabetic medication on the market. It was a whopping study and it now metformin is one of the top-selling drugs in history.
Right.
Well, in the very same study, few paragraphs down, diet was twice as effective as metformin.
Yeah.
Twice as effective.
Right.
So going to your point there. So the study was there, but that part of the study was never, and that was a garbage diet. That wasn't even a very good diet that they used.
There seems to be this general.
So you talk about other types of intervention worked better than the medication. The medication worked to a degree. I mean, it reduced symptoms they were talking about. Well, yeah, it reduced symptomatology, reduced angina, but years later, outcomes are no different.
I think I'm glad you said all that because I think more people need to be aware that that's the case. I mean, I'll mention again, Why We Sleep. There's a book written by Matthew Walker. He's a PhD. I just did a whole podcast on this guy on sleep. One of the things they mentioned is just sleep. Remember how you're talking about exercising. If you sleep less than 6 hours a night, 50% increase in heart disease. They did a study in Greek people that used to be in the siesta culture, right?
Yes.
Took 29,000 people that used to take a nap mid-afternoon, so they got a lot more sleep than average. They tracked these people, and then they tracked the ones that transitioned to a Western lifestyle, basically where we work long hours and we don't take naps and things like that. 50% increase in heart disease in the people who moved from siesta culture, i.e. more sleep, to less sleep.
Yeah.
And 50%?
And we're going to discuss that in a minute. There's some articles here I brought just talking about that kind of thing and why that occurs. But I love this article. It's in American College of Cardiology. And there's also, I have another one, and it talked about, I love this, when they actually did a double-blind study with heart bypass surgery. Well, one, they took a group of patients. I don't know how they did this. They did heart bypass surgery. And the other group, they did sham surgery. Mm-hmm. They mean they cut you open and sewed you back.
Yeah.
Guess what? The results were no different.
Wow. Yeah.
That's bypass surgery had the same outcome as doing sham surgery. That's the American College of Cardiology. How do you like them apples?
Wow.
New England Journal of Medicine. Stents did not provide benefit. Long-term, it will reduce... short-term, it'll give you some relief from pain.
Symptoms. Yeah,
symptom relief, but long-term relief, survival rates were no different.
Which means, but this, that still can mean that you might do a stent. See, I understand what you're saying, but that still can mean long-term, but if they're having pain in front of you, can't relieve it with medications.
The Journal of the American Medical Association, heart stents are useless. And, are they? And then, so the question they're asking is, is it a placebo effect when you do a stent? Long term, 10-year survival rates with stents, you're worse off.
Right.
You're worse off.
Right.
And that's according to the studies, the Journal of American Medicine. And I love this, the sugar industry, and this was published in JAMA, Journal of the American Medical Association, and they ran an article because back in the 60s, 65, New England Journal of Medicine ran a article saying that it was fat and cholesterol caused heart disease. And where did they get the study? Well, it turns out, and they also published it in the New York Times, that Coca-Cola sponsored some research that showed it wasn't sugar that was a contributor of inflammation, obesity, or heart disease. It was fat and cholesterol.
Right.
So who funded the research? Coca-Cola.
Yeah.
The
wow.
sugar industry.
Wow.
And so we're still stuck in that paradigm.
Right.
Do you really trust? Oh, yeah, there are studies out there.
Yeah.
But
who
funded them? You got to always go back. And it's funny because you look at study after study and the outcomes of the study depends on who funded it.
So what I like about you is you have the big historical context of where a lot of this research came from. As he sifts through a pile that's 2 inches thick of journal articles, I mean, this is what the research actually shows. I appreciate you bringing those in.
So now this starts getting to the point you were talking about, cardiac failure and Addison's disease. And Addison's disease is an adrenal insufficiency syndrome. So you're talking about stress.
Right.
When stress starts to fit, what are you going to get? You're going to get adrenal insufficiency. What do they find out? That was a huge factor in cardiac patients. I said, that's something that we don't screen for and we should. If someone is having adrenal issues, you're crushing the heart. What crushes the adrenal glands? Lack of sleep, stress. Yeah, right. And those things we're not really looking at today. And you do a lot. I know. You pay a lot of attention to that. And it's backed up in the studies. And that was in the American Journal of Medicine.
One sidebar on adrenal. In medical school, we're taught about Addison's and Cushing's disease, which are opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to
symptoms
of adrenal. But it's very the discussion of what complementary alternative medicine talk a lot about adrenal fatigue.
Yes.
Well, the thing is, medical doctors really aren't trained about the in-between. And I can tell you, my clinical experience over the last 20 years, there is definitely an in-between.
And things can be subclinical. You want to catch them before they're pathological.
Right.
And we never do that. We wait till the patient's on their death's doorstep,
right,
or it shows up on a lab test.
Right.
It's too late then.
Right.
You know, why you don't want to do maintenance on your car?
Right.
You only fix it when it's broken?
Right. Yep. I agree.
Broke down? You're on the side of the road broken down. It's too late, you know?
Yeah. Here's your stent.
Yeah. And the thing is, I get so aggravated because I see these articles written by Johns Hopkins and others. Oh, these alternative or supportive care people talking about adrenal fatigue. Ah! Now they say, oh, we have adrenal insufficiency.
Yes.
And it's like, well, what's the difference? Yeah. Oh, these people, they just made up this term, adrenal fatigue. What do you want to call it?
Yeah.
Okay, fine, adrenal insufficiency.
Common nomenclature. Let's just call it something common. Yes.
Right. And that's just use that as a barb. That's ridiculous. Increase, and this was in Biomed Research International, increased cardiovascular risk in patients with adrenal insufficiency. So that's what they're finding. Adrenal glands are a big predictor of cardiac problems. And if a patient has cardiac problems, you got to address adrenal glands. Again, another article on adrenal insufficiency. And this was put out by the University of California, San Francisco. And they're showing a lot of heart problems, a lot of heart issues are caused by adrenal insufficiency. Very interesting stuff. High cardiac risk in patients with Cushing syndrome. And what they're saying is patients with Cushing syndromes are have high amounts of cardiovascular complications, and anytime you have a Cushing's patient, you better be looking at the heart.
Right.
Because, you know, they were saying it, they have four times the rates of heart disease.
Yeah,
so there's
huge.
Your opposite ends of the spectrum,
right,
and they're still both affecting the heart,
exactly,
and heart function. But so are we looking, it's like, hyper and hypothyroid. You know, people say, well, those are opposite. Are high blood pressure and low, or high blood sugar and low blood sugar, those are opposite. No, the opposite's health.
Right.
We're looking at a struggling gland.
Right.
You got to nourish it. It's failing. It's telling you. And it's like a light bulb that'll flicker before it goes out. You can have hyper, hypo.
Right.
A gland will do that while it's burning out, while it's struggling.
And any organ, including the heart, can be affected by the nutritional status and can have fluctuating functionality.
Correct.
Fluctuating ability to do its job.
Yeah.
I mean, all the way around.
Absolutely, because when we miss that, we keep trying to treat the symptom.
Yeah.
And not why is that happening? Mike, and this was real nursing and healthcare, this International Archives of Nursing and Healthcare, what they find, micronutrients in congestive heart failure. They're finding out nutrition is playing a huge role in the health of the heart. And that's something that when you start nourishing the patients, my God, heart health comes back. calcium controls cardiac function. And this was in the journal Physiology, published by the Physiology Society. Reversible pulmonary hypertension associated with vitamin C deficiencies. So you're starting to see this stuff making its way into the journals. And that's the journal Chest.
When was that? You know, it's interesting.
2012.
Pulmonary hypertension, I know when I was in medical school, always seemed to be a little bit of a mystery. And okay, it has a few main causes, structural things and whatnot. And then to see something like that, you're like, well, I see patients all the time that have pulmonary hypertension. It's like they're being treated with all kinds of exotic medication cocktails and things like that. And the reality is, I mean, wow, okay, vitamin C deficiency. That at least gives you what I call a therapeutic rationale for maybe treating differently or nourishing the heart rather than simply treating with medication.
Well, let's explore why vitamin C might, because the stuff you buy at the store is ascorbic acid. That's not vitamin C.
Right.
Svent Gyorgy, I actually have one of his journals, and he wrote, you know, ascorbic acid isn't, because that's just it's a chemical.
Yeah.
He said there's other factors in it. Vitamin C actually improves the oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the heart's main function? To carry oxygenated blood to every cell of the body, except the cornea. So if anything that makes that more difficult, you're going to raise tension in the vascular system because the body's desperately trying to get oxygen to cells.
Right.
They're screaming for it. And if vitamin C is responsible for the oxygen-carrying capacity of the blood, one of the factors involved in that, what do you think? It's going to improve it.
Right.
Going to improve the function. So vitamin C is very important. And plus, what is scurvy? When you see scurvy, when you start reading old journals, when they talked about scurvy, it's vascular breakdown.
Right.
Your collagen
capillary fragility. And,
yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Your collagen starts falling apart.
Right.
And so what is the bioflavonoid factors in vitamin C?
Mm-hmm.
So that's what most physicians miss.
Right.
The importance, because they're still stuck in the ascorbic acid thing.
Right.
And even though the person who won the Nobel Prize for the discovery of C said, no, we got it wrong. It's not ascorbic acid. You have to have the tyrosinase. You have to have the vitamin P factors.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason Gyorgy named it P, because he was treating people with hemorrhagic disease, vascular breakdown, with paprika, with peppers, with food extracts.
Right.
And that was the only way he was getting a positive benefit.
He was having success with that.
Yes, and that's why he named it vitamin P.
Right.
Bioflavonoids are called vitamin P, and that's why he coined the term, is after paprika.
Right.
He was treating them with food extracts because there's other factors in vitamins or complexes.
This is why I like the history of this, because if I treated somebody with a hemorrhagic disorder with paprika nowadays, I'd be, you know,
looked at
or whatever.
Yeah.
You know?
But it's in the literature.
But it's there, and there are active factors that the big question for a lot of people is like, well, how much of what we see as disease, I know as a medical doctor, how much of what I see as disease is mostly a nutritional issue?
Yeah, people are, they're starving
to death. We're all morbidly obese in the United States, but yet we have vitamin and mineral deficiencies because of the poor quality of the food we're eating.
And we're just not recognizing these things. Here is the role of anemia in the progression of congestive heart failure. So there was another article, and that was in the journal Nephrology. It's funny, the nephrology journal is very interested in heart function.
Mm-hmm. For sure.
And most people don't realize how important heart function is to kidney health. And also in the University of California, San Francisco, folic acid and B12 show potential as heart disease treatments. So they published that. This is Science Daily. Specific vitamin D levels linked to heart problems. A lack of vitamin D can result in weak bones. Recent studies also show vitamin D deficiencies is linked to serious health risks, such as coronary artery disease, heart attacks, and stroke.
Yeah, that's epidemic. Everybody I see that's pre-diabetic or overweight, almost all of them have a low vitamin D. It's one of those signals that the body is metabolically struggling and obviously tied to heart disease too.
Yeah, and calcium function, which you know calcium is needed for muscle contraction. This Johns Hopkins, vitamin D in the heart, higher risk for cardiovascular disease with people with low vitamin D levels. Association of circulatory iron deficiencies. This was in the Journal of Renal Nutrition. Iron deficiencies with an enlarged heart. So they're starting to find out that people with enlarged hearts, and they go back and test them, have iron deficiencies.
Mm-hmm.
Again, what's the heart's function? It's struggling to oxygenate the blood. And if you're anemic, what's happening?
And it has to work harder.
It has to work harder. And what is anemia? It's a nutritional deficiency,
right.
Unless you're having a bleed somewhere or something of that nature.
You know, another thing that's like a little piece of that pathology that goes on there is the heart. If the heart can't do its job, say its pumping function is weaker because you're anemic or because of you're on a drug that's causing a weakness to the muscle, Well, the body has multiple coping mechanisms for that to maintain blood pressure the way it wants. And the kidneys are asking for a certain amount of blood pressure. The brain is.
Yes.
Well, the blood vessels change. Well, what do? They get tighter because they're trying to maintain blood pressure in a lot of these situations.
Right.
So you get systemic hypertension.
Right.
And then it's sort of this vicious cycle that starts to occur because the heart has to work harder against the tightened, you know, blood vessels.
Yes.
And there you have it. Then we give you a medicine that weakens the heart further.
You know, because you started with congestive heart failure.
Yeah.
So here's what happens. The heart's failing. It's struggling. It's
right.
tired. It's fatigued. So the adrenal glands aren't the adrenals, but the kidneys are dying. So they're going to release a hormone called renin-angiotensin to raise blood pressure.
Right.
So what do? We give a blood pressure drug, which you just said weakens the heart even more.
Right.
So you just created this vicious cycle.
Right.
Instead of saying, okay, why is the heart weak?
Right.
It's not from the lack of the ACE inhibitor. Mm-hmm. You're just treating the symptom of the kidneys trying to stay alive by weakening the heart even more.
Right.
You're killing the patient. This.
Going
down there. So here it is. This is the British Medical Journal. Copper deficiencies may be a leading cause of ischemic heart disease. Going back to anemia again. So we got copper and
nobody
iron.
Nobody even measures that anymore other than if you do a hair analysis or something. Nobody really even measures that.
But that's a cofactor. Again, you're talking about mineral deficiencies,
right.
which you talk about
right.
a lot and you're aware of. But they have to be, to me, they're looking at isolated minerals. I think you got to look at them all together because they have to work in the proper balance.
Right.
And so that's something we don't really look at. And why are people not having good minerals in their body? Why are we mineral deficient? Because everyone's on antacids.
Mm-hmm.
You can only absorb minerals in an acidic stomach.
Right.
And if you're on an antacid, that's it. And
right.
you even look on the bottle of antacid. If you're on an antacid, you're going to be osteoporotic.
Right.
You're
going to
develop.
Yeah, it's a black box warning now. And people just think they're like candy. You can just pop them anytime you want or something. It's not. It actually is causing mineral. And as the journal you're pointing out, you have mineral and absorption problems. Therefore, you become deficient in what seems like it would be.
Yeah.
How would you be deficient in copper? Because you don't absorb it when you should.
Yeah, so you're taking an acid, it's causing heart disease, and
right.
what do they treat? They don't look at, go downstream, say, oh, it could be you're having this heart issue, this congestive heart failure, because you're taking an acid. Who puts that together?
Yeah. Do you think that with heart failure, we're making the case that heart failure, and we've weaved in some heart disease in the mix. When I say heart disease, I'm talking about blocked arteries. But if you look at heart failure, I think probably, I started out by saying heart failure, electrical anomalies of the heart. Those are very similar. I think they go together.
Yes.
I think these people that I just saw a guy the other day that walked in here that, pretty young guy, and he's sitting there in atrial fibrillation. Is the upper part of his heart is quivering, and the lower part is responding to a rapid heartbeat. So he's sitting in front of me with a heart rate of 130, and the heart is irregular. He's prone to clotting. He's prone to stroke. All these kind of things that we worry about with atrial fibrillation. But I was like, the guy's overweight. He doesn't eat very, he doesn't eat right and stuff. But I think there's just definitely overlap in all these mineral deficiencies, cofactor deficiencies, and both of those conditions.
Now here we get into just what you're talking about, electrical conductivity of the heart. And this was in Science Direct. B vitamin deficiencies in hospitalized patients with heart failure. Depletion of water-soluble B vitamins is a key player in the production of cellular energy in heart. Because remember what some of your B vitamins are responsible for, the electrical conductivity of the heart.
Yep.
It's a B vitamin deficiency.
Yep.
And now you're starting to see it play out in the medical literature. Because years ago, Barry, we talked about Barry as a nutritional...
Yeah, I was hoping you'd bring this up. Yeah, I like
and
this.
And it's in the medical, it's starting to wake its way out in the medical literature. Here's WebMD, B vitamins reduce stroke and heart disease deaths. B vitamins reduce stroke and heart disease deaths. This is in Journal Clinical Nutrition. The role of B vitamins in the management of heart failure. Plasma B levels and their relationship to the severity of chronic heart failure. When you look at heart failure, this was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. The amount of plasma B vitamins is a predictor of the strength of their heart.
Oh, lots of people with low B vitamins. I do a lot
yes.
of testing for B vitamins, serum testing, and there's a lot of B vitamin
yes.
deficiency.
Now, when you looked at beriberi in the years past, there was two types of beriberi, dry beriberi and wet beriberi. Dry beriberi was neurological, and wet beriberi was heart disease.
Right.
Which you think about it, they're both tied in. You need electrical conductivity that makes the heart beat, that makes it function.
Right.
And I have, there was a Dr. Vetter. I remember when my son got injured in combat,
right.
and they sent him to Bethesda Medical Center for treatment. And right across from Bethesda Medical Center was Walter Reed Hospital, which was a dump. And the Navy people that ran Bethesda would let you know that it was a dump because Walter Reed was run by the Army. One of the wings to Walter Reed was the Vetter Wing. And Vetter was famous for treating beriberi. And in his book, which I have, he talked about trying to treat beriberi with B vitamins. Didn't work. And help. Only when he gave him food sources of B vitamins.
Not isolated vitamins.
Correct. Yes. Not synthetic chemicals. 99% of all B vitamins today are made by Riley Chemical Company,
right,
the makers of creosote and tar.
Right.
No one has a tar deficiency. These are isolated synthetic vitamins. When he gave them food isolates, whole food concentrates, their beriberi went away.
Interesting, because they get all the cofactors and all the other enzymes that are part of that food.
Correct.
As a whole.
And what you know as a physician in knowing a little bit about chemistry, when plants take in and make vitamins, they make levo forms of the vitamins, not the dextro form, like right. L-carnitine, L-lysine.
Right.
The levo are what's biologically active. So they might be have the same...
It's like a mirror image of the same chemical
exactly,
structure.
Exactly, the isomers.
One works, one doesn't work.
Yeah, they might have the same atomic number, but one works...
One doesn't.
Yeah, or one can actually be a poison.
It's like a key that goes in a door, but it's exactly the one that will work, but it's made backwards.
Backwards, yeah.
So it doesn't go into the, it doesn't
or like,
work.
Or like a nut and a bolt.
Right.
What if I took a left-handed nut and tried
exactly.
to put it on a right-handed bolt? There,
thread could be right, everything could be right,
but
they
won't
screw on. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So that's what you see in natural supplements versus things that are made synthetically in a lab. They structurally, they look the same, but they're mirror opposites. One's going to work in a biological system and one's not.
So very much already, similar to maybe our topic on thyroid, we're starting to move to this concept that whole food nutrition is A, the place where health and performance is, and B, it can be a strong preventative. Yeah. You're even laying out that edgier case, in my opinion, as a medical doctor, it's a little edgier that, no, these things can actually be treated.
Yes.
You know, once they're even a disease process, there should be a and I believe this too, but there's a therapeutic rationale for treating people this way, not simply saying, okay, well, these deficiencies occur, they're associated with this condition. Then why aren't we doing something about that? Why aren't we giving people...
That's not standard care.
Whole food. I know it's not, but it's, to me, that's
and
what we need to be doing.
Yes.
Even for the sickest of the sick, some of them need to be nourished better.
Well, think about it. We got the blueprint.
Yep.
The body just needs to be nourished. That's
yep.
a fact. You
right.
cannot, you can't argue that. That's right. physiology 101.
Right. If it got there, why can't it reverse?
It can.
Yeah.
The heart's one of the most rejuvenative organs in the body.
Mm-hmm.
It will heal. It has to heal. It's designed to.
Right.
So why don't we have faith in the body's ability to heal? I mean, every cell in your body is trying to heal, repair, make energy.
Right.
Well, provide it the building blocks it needs to do so.
Yep.
And we're not doing that. And what doesn't make as much money, Doc? I hate to. There's
that
some.
Be, I'm sure that's a part of it.
And,
yeah.
and a lot of doctors are playing defensive medicine.
Yeah.
They're scared because this is the umbrella of care. And you notice in all these articles I read and all the different types of heart disease, when they talk about, and we haven't got into the things that other factors like inflammation.
Yep.
And that's one reason stents and bypasses they were saying don't work because they cause inflammation. They're causing scarring.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they actually make the problem worse. Nowhere did I mention cholesterol. Nowhere in any of these articles did they talk about in dietary intake of fat or cholesterol.
Right.
Nowhere did they talk about all these factors, the adrenal factors,
it's
nutritional factors.
Heart disease is multifactorial. It comes from multiple things.
Stress.
You know, I've heard it said, you know, cholesterol probably is related, kind of like a fireman is related to a fire.
Correct.
It's definitely related to heart disease because it's in those plaques, but it's not,
But why are the plaques there?
Exactly. That's where we have to go down that road and say, no, how did go one more step upstream? How did this happen? Why is there? I think it's all about insulin, which in turn ties it into, you know, the idea of nutrition. Because if your insulin level is high, it's unbalanced, you're overweight in your midsection, your blood pressure is going to be higher because of high insulin. There's all these factors that suggest that is probably the bigger absolute trigger. Now, if you smoke... or you are inactive, these are other factors that play into it. But most clearly, people with high insulin, if you look at what the risk factors are for heart disease, it's clearly high insulin levels.
Journal of Diabetes and Metabolism, Insulin Resistance and Type 2 Diabetes. Insulin resistance is a hallmark of type 2 diabetes mellitus and is associated with metabolic and cardiovascular disorders because it sclerosis the arteries.
Yep.
We know that.
Yeah, sclerosing's like that. That well, it's the blockage. It's that.
Yes.
In the
journal Atherosclerosis, the relationship between insulin resistance and vascular calcification in coronary arteries. What causes sclerosing of the arteries? They said insulin, and that's in the journal Atherosclerosis. We know that. It's in the medical literature.
Right.
It's not cholesterol. If I cut myself, what happens? I form a scab.
Yeah.
So if I come to you with this wound, you're going to pull my scab off, right?
Right.
No, that's insane. No. You're not. So. If something damages your artery, the body's not going to just let it bleed out internally. It's going to put a band-aid on it. It's got a patch on it.
Right.
That's cholesterol.
Right.
The body's cholesterol is there to help. That's a reaction to an injury.
Right.
So treating that scab or treating the body's trying to fix an injury, to me, is insanity.
Yeah.
Instead of treating the cause of that injury, which you just said here is insulin resistance is one of the primary causes of atherosclerosis. Now, we treat vascular disease all the time, but you're going upstream actually looking at heart disease,
right,
which no one has answers for that. What causes the heart to be weak? Like you said, when your heart muscle's weak and you have congestive heart failure, which a lot of times is a B vitamin deficiency because that's responsible for the electrical conductivity of the heart.
Exactly.
We're just reading that. And here's another article. This was in the journal Circulation, very big medical journal. It said beriberi heart disease, and a B vitamin deficiency is the primary cause of that. Very big medical journal. Again, we're not addressing those issues. We're so far behind. Now arterial disease, mm-hmm, insulin resistance. And here's another article that talk about infections are also a big deal, sclerosing the arteries.
Right.
Then I love these, depression and coronary heart disease. Patients may be at higher risk for myocardial infarctions who are under stress. Depressed people have higher risk of MIs. Short-term sleep deprivation, this was in Science Daily, affect heart function. You were just talking about that.
Yep.
Sleep duration as a risk factor for cardiovascular disease. And this was also in, the government, I was on the government website. I pulled that off of one of the CDC websites. I love this, the research, broken heart syndrome. Mm-hmm. People who are depressed, who have had trauma in their life. Uncovering, this was in the Harvard Medical Journal, uncovering the link between emotional stress and heart disease.
The immune system is affected by our thought and vice versa.
They talk about how this affects the release of cortisol.
Yep.
And what does cortisol do? It raises heart rate, it raises blood pressure, and it raises blood sugar levels, thereby triggering insulin.
Yep.
So you got a trifecta going on there.
Yep.
And if you're doing this time after time after time, you know, you're doing that to the heart and you're doing that to the vascular system day after day after day. Eventually, you know, it's going to collapse. You can't keep it up forever.
I think you've made a strong argument for the value of looking at the heart differently and from the perspective it should be nourished. And there are lifestyle factors that can be as big or arguably bigger than treating the symptoms once they occur. My question to you at this juncture, so what is an ideal, if you're going to... We've laid out the case for, you know, cholesterol isn't the issue. We've laid out the case that inflammation is an issue. But looking at the heart in general, what does it look like for you? Optimal prevention, strong heart. Not just prevention, because we're
right,
talking about the WFO Life podcast. We want to be better than average. We want to be able to do more than just not be sick.
Right.
What does that look like to you? What does that therapy look
first
like?
First of all, if you find yourself in a hole, quit digging. That's
sure.
At Bay, we're a construction company. We go out and we build stuff. We got our workers out there working their tails off. But what if I took a garbage truck and I went out to the job site and I started dumping garbage out there?
Right.
The worker's going to have to come off their job and start cleaning up garbage.
Right.
What if I'm eating things that weren't meant to be in my system? Like, let's say Captain Crunch. Let's say
right,
Fruit Loops. Let's say
say
soft
it ain't
drink.
So
come
no,
on,
I don't
these
think that's
Snickers
that
bars. Oh, yeah, it gives you energy. Yeah.
Yeah.
The body's got to stop what it's doing,
yeah,
and it's got to get this garbage out of the system. So your body, instead of repairing and healing and making energy, is doing what? It's turned into a garbage collection system.
Yeah, it's cleaning up.
You don't want it doing that. You don't want it. So first of all, you got to quit the garbage. you got to stay away from the high fructose corn syrups. You got to stay away from the sugar, the processed food. Can you imagine having to say this? This is radical thought. And right. Stay away from bread and cereal and pasta. You say, why? It gives you energy short term.
Yeah.
Long term is causing high insulin levels, causing sclerosing in the arteries. What happens to livestock when you feed them grain?
They get fat.
You get fat. You raise cows.
Right.
You want to make them fat? You give a pig corn. Give it grain. Right. You want to make it fat? Well, we're no different.
Right.
And so you're putting all the sugar and soft drink. And you always preach, man, if I can just get my patients to do one thing, quit drinking liquid sugar.
Death in a can. Sodas are death in a can.
Yeah, I hear Dr. Curtis preaching that all the time. Quit the liquid sugar.
Yeah, put I had a lady tell me the other day, I started to get one, and I thought of you saying, death in a can. back. I was like, excellent. I'm glad I don't know that worked.
Breakfast cereals. We're sending our kids to school on breakfast cereal.
And skim milk.
Oh, my God. If you give a cow skim milk, it'll die. Yeah. And yet we're eating it.
Yeah.
What in the heck are
we
doing? So, quit digging. So you got to eliminate the garbage out of our systems. The other thing is we need to start eating whole foods that contain the B vitamins, that contain the nutrients, the micronutrients, the microRNAs, the coenzymes, the enzymes, all the cofactors you were talking about, and some we don't even know of yet. So what would that look like? We'll eat things like full fat meat. Mm-hmm. The other dirty little thing about minerals and mineral absorption and B vitamins, you need fat to absorb them. A lot of your B vitamins are fat soluble vitamins.
Right.
And without fat, you're not getting them. And we're all put on these low fat diets.
Right.
And what the studies actually are showing is it's not fat and cholesterol. It's all these other factors we're talking about. And we just talked about fat reduces inflammation. Remember the first study we talked about?
Yeah, absolutely.
I said we'd go back to that eventually. Mm-hmm. You also need fat to absorb minerals. Fat is the vehicle that drives the minerals into the tissues of the body, like the heart.
Right.
And a lot of times you'll graph a heart and a person will lose second heart sounds, the S2. That's a hallmark of calcium deficiencies. And a lot of times you'll give them cataplex F, which is your essential fatty acids, and the second heart sound will come back.
Yep.
So what was a calcium deficiency? But you gave them fat because fat drove the calcium into the muscle.
Yeah, moved it into the tissue it needed to be in.
They had the minerals. Yeah, it was in their body, but the body couldn't use it.
Right.
Fat's essential for life. That's why they call them essential fatty acids. So we got to get out of this mindset that fat's bad for us. Fat's probably one of the most essential nutrients we eat.
Mm-hmm.
So you full fat meat. You also need fat to metabolize protein. So that can be a very dense, positive source of nutrition. Eggs, especially egg yolks.
Right.
Dense in B vitamins. Very powerful, powerful food there. Everything needed for life is in an egg.
Right.
It grows life. You've seen it grow
Absolutely.
Life.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You've done it yourself.
All right.
So very powerful foods. Vegetables are good.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not everyone saying, vegetables are the greatest thing in the world. I don't think so. I think they're good. I think they're healthy. They don't raise insulin levels. They don't raise blood sugar
right.
levels, unless you're eating a rutabaga or something. But we live in South Texas. We've probably
never seen one of those.
Yeah. But an elephant, I give this example a lot. I think I gave it before. An elephant has to eat its weight and vegetation every day to stay
right.
alive. Well, a tiger, who is a 400-pound animal, can live on 5 pounds of meat a day.
Mm-hmm.
What's your densest source of nutrition? Yeah. I always look at foods that give me the biggest bang for the buck.
Right.
Vegetables are healthy, but they don't contain all your essential amino acids. They don't contain vitamin B12. They don't contain your essential fatty acids. They don't contain A, E, D, and K. They don't contain all of those factors that are essential for human life.
Well, it also makes sense because if you look at what foods, say you're trying to lose weight, the foods that most satiate people and make them less hungry are the very dense foods, fats and proteins.
Yes.
Those are the ones that make you not hungry.
Correct. And what are we made out of?
Yep.
Protein, which you can't metabolize without fat.
Right.
Your DNA only synthesizes for protein, not
right.
sugar.
Right.
And I say, well, how about energy? Well, that's what fat's for.
Right.
You want your body metabolizing fat, not storing it. When every time you raise insulin levels, what does insulin do? What's it there for? To take sugar out of the blood and store it as fat.
Any specific nutritional whole food supplements you tend to use, let's say for patients with heart disease, with actual blocked arteries, if they wanted to support their heart, good strong heart, and getting the right minerals and vitamins into the heart to augment, you know, or try to reverse some of the changes they've had in the heart? What do you like
now
to
again
use?
I'm not advertising anything here,
exactly.
But one of the companies that I use and the backbone is a company called Standard Process,
right?
Because they've been around about 90 years and they produce whole food extracts,
right?
So when you take a B vitamin, you're getting the food source of that vitamin,
right?
With all the factors there, plus the B4, which the Canadian government says is essential for heart function. B4 is essential for the electrical conductivity of the heart, but the U.S. federal government says no, B vitamin is not needed for human health. So, Standard Process Cataplex B is one of the most essential nutrients or supplements you could take for a healthy heart. And that's made a huge difference in mine, because you actually found an issue with mine years ago when you did an EKG. You said, man, there's something here. I was able to turn that around by taking Cataplex B. Mm-hmm. And that made a huge difference because, you know, being an athlete, you know about athletes, we don't do things for health. We don't have the healthiest lifestyles that's built for performance. We put a lot of stress on our system and we don't put enough back. And so I had a very nasty little heart condition that really responded well to nutrition. It took me 6 months to a year to fix it. Mm-hmm. It took me a long time, but it did. Mm-hmm. It made a huge, huge improvement.
It took time to replenish and absorb all that. Yeah.
So Standard Process makes whole food. And if there's a better company out there, we'll use them.
Yeah, it's food-based and high quality.
Now, that's the best one I know of right now. And now if there's a better one that comes around, I'll switch. But so far, that's the best. Cardiovascular health, there's a product called Cyruda and Cyruda Plus. Harvard Review, you can go look it up, found the greatest blood thinner ever discovered, better than warfarin, better than any blood thinner. It doesn't interfere with clotting factors and it's a vascular strengthener. It was called rutin, which is a bioflavonoid.
Made from buckwheat, right?
Made from buckwheat. Number one source is buckwheat. That's Cyruda, which Standard Process started making in 1950. So they were way ahead of the curve in a lot of these with their founder, Dr. Royal Lee, who came up with a lot of these formulations. But Cyruda and Cyruda Plus is, according to University of Harvard, greatest vascular strengthener. If you're worried about stroke, improving vascular function, those are the two of the best supplements you can use. You can use calcium lactate. Very important for heart function is calcium. Why lactate? Because it's in a lactic acid form, which makes it an ionizable calcium, which makes it absorbable. So for muscle function, very, very important. Cataplex F, cod liver oil, or tuna omega. Those will help get the minerals into the tissues where they need to be.
And the calcium in there.
Yes. So those are very good. Always look for thyroid support or adrenal support when you're dealing. And you're also talking about how the brain affects the heart. When you're having trouble and you can't figure out what's going on, sometimes ask patients or ask yourself, have there been any head traumas, closed head injuries in the past? You'll be surprised because the brain affects heart function. Closed head injuries, you'll be surprised how often that'll affect heart function, and that needs to be addressed at some point in time. Did they have fevers when they were a kid, rheumatic fever? Because that can have led to valve damage.
Issues, yep. Yeah. Rheumatic heart disease.
And you'd be surprised how many people, I did have high fevers as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we were treating heart conditions and they're not responding the way you should. We'll take that next step. And you're very good at that. I've noticed you've caught things with patients that other doctors weren't thinking about, weren't thinking along those lines. And you caught them. So those are some things that for me are very, very important. And there's others that are helpful for the heart, but those are the main.
That's the main stuff. So let's cap that. I will add to what you just said. According to research, even in Dr. Matthew Walker's book, Why We Sleep, 7 to 9 hours of sleep is necessary. And I think the human body was meant to be active. Even patients that have class 3 heart failure have been shown to have improvements in functionality when they're active. So do what you can with what you have, where you can, when you can. I think this is going to be a classic from the new, I guess we'll call it the Health Corner episodes we've been doing of the WFL Life podcast, because a lot of people have questions along these, the topic of heart disease, heart failure, how do I prevent it? And I think you've made probably one of the stronger arguments that I've heard you make for the idea, the value of nourishing the heart. And so I really appreciate you coming in and doing this episode. Mm-hmm. Any final thoughts on this?
Yeah. Now, I know I'm very critical of the medical profession and medical doctors as a whole, but I think if you don't have a good medical doctor in your corner, you're a fool. I've said that because you guys are superlative at diagnosing conditions, right, and you save a lot of lives. So sometimes we have a disagreement. I have a disagreement mostly with the profession, with the pharmaceutical companies, the advertisements, the politics that goes into
right.
it. Not with individual doctors. They're
sure.
they're out there doing the best they can with the system they've been placed in.
Right.
But sometimes it's good to have some philosophical discussions.
Yeah.
That's how we can improve
things. I think it's super important. John, thanks again. Until next time.
Thank you, sir.
All right.